This is a Collider.com audio interview.
How are you doing today?
This has been an amazing week. It really has.
I can imagine. When did you?
I never thought I could have this much fun without sleeping.
When did you find out that the film got in?
To Sundance?
Yeah.
Right before Thanksgiving, which made the holidays a whole lot more fun. You probably heard, I had a short film here 11 years ago.
Yep.
And this dream of coming full circle and bringing my premiere here, I thought initially when I came here, I had such a great time at so many great filmmakers because part of the whole circus, and I'm like, I'll be back in 2 years. And each year that passed, I wondered if that was ever going to happen. So 11 years later, to finally get that phone call to say, you're in, come back home, just was so poignant to me. Honestly, it was one of the top 3 phone calls in my entire life thus far.
Was it always the plan for Sundance, or was it always a chance, maybe Toronto, or you know what I mean?
For personal reasons, I wanted Sundance.
Okay. How tough was it for... Let's talk a little bit about finance and getting the film off the ground. And I love the fact that I'm sitting next to a vacuum or something. Talk a little bit about how tough was it to getting the financing on this thing. Was it... You know what I mean?
When you're a first-time director, you're often considered what's called a deadly attachment in the eyes of financiers because, they're trusting you with a lot of money.
Sure.
To bring something home, to get great performances, to not have a nervous breakdown in the process. And I wish I did things smaller. If this movie were 4 people in a room, I probably would have gotten this movie made. It wouldn't have taken 9 years to make, rather. But, you saw the movie. It's a period piece. It's a multi-character, somewhat epic, with musical sequences and, over 30 locations. And, that's a lot for a most financiers. They looked at that and they said, I don't know if you're going to be able to pull that off. And we almost got this made several times. I brought Christine Vachon on from Killer Films about a little over 4 years ago, and the movie almost made it to pre-production then, only to fall apart, and then it happened again. And then about 2.5 years ago, Jesse Eisenberg, who was attached to the film at that time to star as Allen Ginsberg, Social Network came out, and he called me up, and he said, John, I think I just played the most iconic Ivy League college student role I will ever play in my entire life. I think I need to play grown-ups now. And I totally understood. And it was at that time that a former sales agent said to me, John, it's over. This movie's never going to happen. Put it away. Go take another couple of years and write something else. But here's the crazy thing. 2 years before that, when I was meeting Jesse and other actors for the role, the other actor I wanted for the role was Daniel Radcliffe. And I sat down with him. We got to know each other. It was an instant love connection. We spent hours kind of sharing our most intimate secrets. And then this will show you what kind of actor he is. He offered to audition for me. Who the fuck does that? And I'm serious. He wanted to make sure. He knew that this was going to be intense. He wanted to make sure that the chemistry was real between the two of us and that the way he would portray the role is the way that I saw it in my own head.
Sure.
And, I almost gave him the role in the room, but then I called his agents up, and they're like, John, just a reminder, he's got 2 films he's got to do before this one, a.k.a. Deathly Hallows 1 and 2, and he's not going to be available for 2 years. So let's jump forward in time again. Jesse Eisenberg's no longer on the movie. The movie's falling apart. I think to myself late at night, oh, my God, I have Daniel Radcliffe's email address. And I'm like, do I dare just do this? And I'm like, fuck it. It's been so long. You've tried so hard. Let's just see if this works.
Sure.
And so I emailed him and I said, hey, Dan, I hope you don't think I'm a stalker. But remember meeting me in that role that you were interested in 2 years ago? If you're still interested, please let me know. I'd love to work with you. If not on this, maybe perhaps on something else one day. Let me know what you think. And he wrote me back the next morning, one word. Abso-fucking-lutely.
I found, speaking to a lot of actors and just directors and everything, that, and even with me, with publicists, that often, you know...
I like your nail polish, by the way.
Thank you. Often, what will happen is that the publicist or somebody thinks it's a bad idea and won't even connect the dots. You know what I mean? Or doesn't want to approve something, but then you just email the actor or the director directly, and they're like, oh, of course I want to do this. So it's just about, you know, bridging the connection. Sometimes you have to do that.
In this case, it worked. Do I suggest other people do it? It's a case-by-case scenario. Some people, obviously, you know, get so many requests, and everybody wants a piece of them. They liked having the, you know, wall of representation in order to deal with it. In this case, I'm very lucky that Dan and I did get along so well that he felt comfortable in responding to me personally.
So once you had Dan, tell me what happens then in terms of...
What happens then is I get told by foreign sales agents that Daniel Radcliffe can't open a movie without a wand in his hand.
Okay.
And I tell them he's playing Allen Ginsberg. I promise you there will be a wand in his hand by the end of the movie. But no, he couldn't open a movie at that time, they told me.
Right.
And so I just did what I decided to do is rather than chase after, you know, another really big movie star with lots of value, I was like, you know what? I'm just going to social network cast this. I want to get a group of young actors whose work I really admire together. And I think by seeing Daniel Radcliffe plus all of these great young actors, the financial upside of this movie will just start coming through by people seeing it's a cool fucking movie. And so my boyfriend loved Entreatment and pointed out Dane DeHaan to me. I love Boardwalk Empire. Jack Houston, incredible actor.
He really is.
Ben Foster, somebody I've admired and wanted to work with for years. Michael C. Hall, 6 Feet Under, is my favorite show of all time. And Jennifer Jason Leigh. I told my boyfriend, we started dating 9 years ago. He asked me what actress I'd like to work with most at some point in my career, and the answer was Jennifer. So with the help of our casting director, Laura Rosenthal, we just put together this really cool, eclectic group of people, and that just started, I think, speaking for itself to the financiers as a movie that they felt comfortable investing in.
So was it... Talk a little bit about landing these people without having the financing set up. Is it sort of like you're taking meetings with people, showing them the script,
yep,
and then saying, hey, I'm putting this together. Do you want to do this?
I mean, the first thing, obviously, is they like the script. That's what got them to sit down with me. And the second thing is, you know, I auditioned for them. I watched every piece of their work before I met with them. And I looked to see what they already had done and done really well, and also the things, more importantly, that they hadn't done yet. And then when I went to them and talked about why I wanted them for each role, not only did I just talk about the role and why I was so passionate about making this film, but I specifically talked about them and what I loved about their work and what I thought I felt really confident that they could do that they hadn't gotten the chance to yet. Because, you know, for a director or an actor, any creative person, the chance to show new colors and show the world that you're not just what they think you are is one of the most appealing things in the world. And, you know, I would ask them personally, they might have other things to say, but for me, that's what I felt I needed to do to show them that I knew who they were and that they could trust me.
From the script that you presented them when you were first going around meeting with everyone, including Daniel, to what we saw on the screen, how much changed or
sure,
not at all?
It didn't change that much, but I definitely, once each actor came on board, I worked with each actor to kind of tailor the role for them. I let them have creative input. I wanted them to be as attached to the project. And I said to all of them, as long as it still works for me in terms of moving the story forward and I get what I need, let's tailor the role for you. Let's play around. And so there were minor rewrites here and there with each actor. And then, of course, there were the constant rewrites of, oh, we can't afford to have a football field and Jack Kerouac throwing a ball across the field with a group of 80 extras.
Sure.
So the football went into his apartment with the rest of the cast. So there were constant rewrites just based on budget and practicality that went on over the course of putting this film together with these particular guys.
Talk a little bit about how long is the finished version? I forget the running time.
About an hour and 39 minutes.
What was your assembly cut? How long was it?
It wasn't that long, actually.
Okay.
That's a good thing about having no time to shoot. You didn't shoot that much, so it can't be that long. Right. I think the assembly was two hours long.
So... For the running time, for what I finally saw on screen and what everyone saw, were there any deleted scenes, or was it pretty much everything you shot is up there?
There are several deleted scenes. scenes I'm really proud of, but scenes that were keeping the pace of the movie from moving forward or felt repetitive once we saw the whole movie assembled together. But there may indeed one day be a longer cut of the movie, but I would only do that if I went back and I looked at the scenes in the context of how the film is built now and thought that they continued to enrich the narrative and move the story forward.
See, but the good thing, see, you've sold, you're with a studio now, and eventually this is coming out. By the way, do you know when it's coming out? Have they?
I have a meeting at 11 o'clock tonight, and I'm going to find out.
Right, that's very funny. What I'm saying is studios love on Blu-rays to be able to put deleted scenes or the extended cut and sell it. So
I would definitely include the deleted scenes, but just me personally, obviously I have to talk to some other people about this. They're all great scenes, and I think, you know, for me, whenever I watch deleted scenes, it's always a good lesson to see why they were deleted and to understand what, you know, dramatic doubling is, for example, in a movie, or pace-wise, where they were having issues and why that was taken out, and to see, you know, and then we each get to play personal critic and say, they should have put that one back in.
Sure.
Or totally got why it's out.
Film or digital?
Film.
Ooh, interesting.
Film. That was mandatory for me and for my cinematographer, Reed Morano. Reed shoots on film most of the time while most people are turning to digital. It's just the medium and the tactile, you know, the use of color and skin tone, et cetera, that she responds to the most. And I always set out to shoot this on film because I wanted it to feel partially like a relic of the 1940s, using color palettes from the 1940s, but at the same time, finding a way, using camera style, using speed, using jump cuts, etc., to make it feel contemporary. And in that contrast, made kind of where the voice of the movie would come through.
Are you a big story? Well, for this film, did you do a lot of storyboards, or do you like finding your shots on set?
I started to storyboard. I can't draw for shit. But Reed, my cinematographer, looked at them and said, uh-uh, John. And I said, why not? She goes, we can shot list, but one of the reasons you hired me, and this is absolutely true, is her intuition is just golden. She's almost like she's like a documentary filmmaker, that she is three steps ahead and knows where the actor's going. And she dances with the camera in a way I've never seen anybody dance before. And just based on intuition and blocking the scene in the actual location together, what we would do is do a rehearsal, and then she and I would shot list and talk about the moments we cared about the most and how to capture them, and then move forward with that plan. And that way, it allowed her the creative freedom, if something new came up, because each scene in this movie was shot in like 2 hours, to just be able to capture it. Because every time we storyboarded the murder, we storyboarded a couple of sequences, but then again we realized on day two that there was no time to shoot as storyboarded.
Sure.
Like the scene when Allen Ginsberg and Lucien Carr are sitting on the steps of Columbia together, and Allen is convincing Lucien to stay, to not leave school. Slight spoiler alert.
Right.
12 minutes we shot that scene in. We got told we had to leave Columbia 4 or 5 hours earlier than we had expected. And so basically what you don't see is the entire crew wrapping up behind us. And we literally shot that scene, I believe, without cutting the camera. We may have cut it once, but without cutting the camera, and just having the actors reset their own hair, reset the props, and without cutting, going and doing coverage on the scene.
I was going to ask you about permits at Columbia.
Columbia was extremely helpful, actually. Columbia came on board pretty early, which was what was really cool. That was one of the things I was worried about. But they read the script, and it came down to they loved the script, and they loved the idea of continuing how the Beat legacy formed at Columbia University, which is absolutely true.
Sure, it's good publicity for the school.
It is, and I think, you know, it was a way to keep Columbia's history alive in film and to an entirely new and young audience.
Obviously, this is all based on what happened, but every film is, you know, Hollywoodized, if you will, or, you know, little liberties are taken here or there. How much were you beholden to what actually happened in the writing process, and how much were you like, I need the story to get from here to here, and it's sort of missing this?
You know, the film is mostly true, but I will tell you this. The Beats never broke into the Columbia Library and sold the dirty books from the shelves and put them in the vitrines, but that may have happened in my life.
So there's a little the little, I understand. When did you first learn about these guys and what they did and how they met? And when was it, like, it first came into you and you're like, I really want to tell this story?
Yeah. I was a Beat lover since, you know, like a lot of us, 16, 17 years old. You know, I grew up in a suburban town, and the idea of finding my own voice and starting a cultural rebellion is very romantic and attractive to me. And to add to that, you know, when I was reading Allen Ginsberg for the first time, I was still a closeted gay guy. And to read someone who was so open with his sexuality and his, through his guts and his stomach and his heart and even his balls out there for the world to see. I remember reading that and feeling like I was reading a dirty novel in the college library. And so I always kind of had a special connection with him. He kind of gave me strength when I needed it. And so my college roommate, Austin Bunn, who's one of my best friends, brought the story to me 9 years ago because he had a similar connection with the Beats. And when he told me this story, at first he said he wanted to write a tone poem, an ode to David Cameron. And I was like, dude, don't write the tone poem. But he was a playwright at that time. He goes, well, then maybe I should write a play about it. And I thought to myself, hell no. And I gave him the Jedi eye mind trick and was like, no, you are going to write this as a screenplay and I am going to teach you how.
Right.
And that's kind of like the origin of how we started playing around with this.
Talk a little bit about when you first found out the film was basically, because you come here obviously to sell the movie. You want the world to see what you've done. Talk a little bit about when you first found out that, you know, this is actually going to sell, because many projects come here and, you know, nowadays it can go on VOD. There's a lot more avenue for distribution. But, you know, when did you first realize or hear that this is going to sell and it's going to really be picked up?
I found out 5 minutes before the world did. I did. I just, when you've been around as long as I have and you've seen things come together and fall apart, like, I don't take anything for granted. And I don't believe that something happens now until it actually happens. And so I actually asked not to be part of all of the excitement and the conversations and the are they or are they going to not. I said, let me know when it looks like something's going to happen and let me know who the people are. And when they called me and said Sony Classics, I said, are you fucking kidding me? I mean, honestly, I thought about different places in my homes and I didn't, you know, they work with such auteurs and they work with such established filmmakers generally. Sure. I thought that this was, I don't know, maybe I'm not giving myself enough credit. Let's just say to be in the company of the films they represent, I just feel it's the right home for this. They get it, they love it, and they want to share it with the world, and I couldn't be happier that it's these guys helping me.
When the film was being shot, we were even running like the paparazzi photos, if you will. You know, there was a lot of interest. Were you surprised at the level of interest by people photographing and all the pictures getting online? Or were you sort of like, and was it like...
Hell no. We had Daniel Radcliffe on the streets of New York with no trailers. We literally were like sitting on stoops, you know, eating our lunch. I was surprised actually that there wasn't as many as there were. Once they got the initial photos, things really chilled out. And people in New York were just like, they'd walk by and be like, Radcliffe, what's up? It was like, I don't know. It was really, we shot a scene with Ben Foster and Michael C. Hall in the middle of Riverside Park. And people were walking by. And, you know, they noticed that Dexter was standing there. And they gave a little nod. But nobody bothered us.
Right. That's amazing, though.
It was really, I don't know if it was just... That's the way New Yorkers are.
They're not. They were being very respectful.
Then people really were respectful of us in the process. And, okay, one really funny story. So, day two, we're shooting a scene with Dana Radcliffe and Dane DeHaan in an exterior outside, them stumbling out of a bar. Just as the school bus pulls up. Just as 100 children see Daniel Radcliffe in front of a camera across the street. And they started to scream and... Howl, and the ADs couldn't stop them. The locations people went over and tried to quiet them down so we could get the shot. No one could do it. And Daniel Radcliffe turns to me and goes, John, let me take care of this. And he walked over to them and said, hey, everybody, we're making a movie. It's imagination time, so everybody be very quiet. And they did. 2 seconds later, Absolute silence, and they watched the scene take place.
Well, that's the magic of Harry Potter, though. You know, the kids just saw Harry and, you know.
Although, we should also say the magic of Daniel Radcliffe.
Sure, but I would imagine they were losing their mind seeing someone, you know. So what in the time it took for you to get this project in front of the screens, I would imagine you've probably been developing or trying to develop other things or writing other things or interested in other things. Is there anything, are you the type of person that you have like five things deep that you're like now can go out and talk about? Or is it, you know what I mean?
I promise I will tell you more information when I can, but yes, I may have something that's in the coffers, and I may have something new that I'm working on with Austin, and there may be a couple of things out there that I'm eyeing right now. You know, I'd love to make a second film. I'd love to make a third. I'd love to have a long career doing this. I know sometimes it takes a long time to get these things done, and one lesson that I've learned from this is find a couple, because you never know when one's going to hit. And make sure, most importantly, that your heart's in each one of them.
Yeah, I mean, why look at it like I've been watching this industry now hardcore for 7 years, you know, doing the site. And there's a reason why even directors like Spielberg attach themselves to five different things. Or Del Toro attaching himself to so many different things. Because even the biggest people, you know, the magic...
It's like the fucking Dark Crystal, man. The light has to hit the crystal at the right percentage time and the angle at the moment that you put the stone in the ruby holder. I mean, it's amazing and a miracle that any film gets made. You have so many moving parts. So that totally makes sense to me.
Yeah, the good news is that you delivered a fantastic... This feature is fantastic, and you have this great performances. And that's something else. Is not only... And I'm putting myself in this industry, in this interview, but your direction is really fucking good.
Thank
and
you.
Your performances are phenomenal.
Thank you.
You know what I mean? So I think that this, no matter what, is going to... You know, you're going to show this to a whole bunch of people and be like, please, may I have some money? You know, I can do this. You know what I mean? Something along those lines.
I will say it's nice having broken my first-time filmmaker, having popped my first-time filmmaker cherry. I'm no longer a deadly attachment. I'm very happy about that.
I understand completely. I'm going to leave you with that and say, as I said, congratulations, man. I really do...